Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daoust, Thursdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome. Another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. And we're going to continue our voyage into the cultures of consciousness. Today, political consciousness, and particularly in the sense that as we get more wired and cybernetic in our awareness of the world, so much so that sometimes, you know, you can be plugged into your media streams and it almost feels tactile, like events occur and you recognize them instantly, and then there's all this discourse and the sense of almost like this collective surface that's constantly moving and tugging in all these different directions that we're all kind of participating in one way or the other. And even though things are, of course, very turbulent in many ways these days, there's also a sense or a way in which all of our media kind of reproduce a certain sense of sameness. You know, you look at the same news feeds, the same kind of language, the same, you know, front page of the New York Times, the same organization of the news program, and it creates this kind of sense that even though things are changing, there's a sort of regularity, almost a kind of something we can kind of rely on. And then occasionally things happen, natural disasters are obvious ones, where it really feels like for a moment, you know, something really intense has happened, something is actually going on, or a significant assassination, incredibly punctuated events. But then there's this other thing that happens that I still haven't figured out a way to really get my finger on, where you feel like, in a way, there's sort of a surge, not a specific event, but a surge in the collective mind, a new sort of jet of awareness, of consciousness, of concept. And it sort of drives for a time our sense of the possibility of politics, of the possibility of the global mind, the network of news that we, you know, use and rely on for the most part, and I might use news in the broadest sense, in order to get a sense of what's going on. And I think the last year we had a number of events like that. We really saw the Arab Spring, the Occupy movement, and this sort of sense that there was actually some real space for change that could occur in a kind of unpredictable way, sort of outside of the normal zones where we usually see political desires expressed and, of course, often constrained. So going into those issues of political consciousness and trying to get a finger on the pulse of the zeitgeist, today we're going to talk to J.P. Arpaigny. It's the second time he's been on Expanding Mind. I think he was on very early when Maj and I started the show. He was a radical in the late 60s in New York and, you know, participated in the anti-war movement and is a very keen observer of politics and culture, and has written a number of books. We'll get to him in just a second. Well, I want to mention some of the books that he did. He wrote a book about genetic manipulation called Double Helix Hubris, and a really great book called Political Ecosystems, which it really blew my mind because it's sort of relevant to the topics we'll be talking about today, because it makes a point in a way that's very kind of simple when you think about it, but it's so much goes against the grain of how we think about politics, because we usually think about positions and about taking a certain kind of position and what's the right position and what's wrong about the wrong positions. Whereas, you know, politics, like almost everything else in life, is a kind of ecology where there's many different actors, many different interactions that are going on, and that, you know, really what you're looking at is a place where people who have differing views of how to approach an event, like the difference between radical environmental, quote-unquote, terrorists, and mainstream, middle-of-the-road organizations, both have a role to play. And that it's wrong to say, well, they're right and they're wrong, but actually there's a kind of more holistic and complex truth about how politics can be conceived. And it's a really great way to get outside of the kind of positional, opinion-driven, argumentative, point-counterpoint style, which is a real poison on the mind in our world. But before we get to JP, of course, bring on our co-host here, Maja Daou. Maja, welcome back.
Thanks, Aaron.
How much news do you take in? Do you like just pick and choose? Do you have a habit of reading the New York Times or following Twitter, or do you just get what comes your way?
I'm pretty picky about where I get news. I do get
I have, you know, my Facebook peeps that I pick that have pick good, like, kind of news stories. But I tend to get a lot of my everyday kind of news from the BBC, actually, or Al Jazeera, because I find that those are usually a little better than, like, CNN. I just look at CNN and MSN or whatever, and I'm just like, ugh. It just, you can tell they're lying by looking at it with your eyes. I don't know. It just bums me out.
Yeah, but sometimes it's fun to watch really terrible news. It's like, I mean, if you're in the right headspace, if you're in the wrong headspace, it can be a big bummer.
It's true. It's like laughable. It is. It's completely retarded to see some of that. Like, I'll watch Fox News, and I'll just be like, oh my God, like, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's guffawable.
Yeah, it's really incredible. I use Twitter a lot now. I'm kind of amazed at how much interesting a sort of more kaleidoscopic view can come through by following the links that people post, because I try to follow a lot of people who post a lot of stories. Not so much, I mean, some of them are newsy, some of them are more just kind of think pieces, odd angles, and you can almost sort of curate your sources in this interesting way that I really quite enjoy, and then I still go to the, you know, New York Times, and I listen to the BBC and The Guardian. But in any case, enough of this. Well, let's bring JP onto the show. JP, thanks for coming back to Expanding Minds.
Glad to be here.
Excellent, excellent. Well, you know, I wanted to start out just because I know it's such a, it's a long time ago, but I'd love to hear a little bit about, before we talk about some of these contemporary movements, just to hear from you about your own experiences in radical politics and protest back in the day, not to sort of say that, you know, that those were the golden years of political radicalism, but there's just some interesting resonances, I think, between the activist movements then and some of the things we've seen recently, both contrasts and similarities. And so I thought it would be great, probably because you have some interesting experiences there to tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the main things that pertains to today, because I don't want to just indulge in disgusting nostalgia for its own sake, is that there are certain, you know, one tends to want to make parallels with historical events, and there that can be instructive and it can also be a mistake. But when one looks at the situation, let's say in 1968, when there were the riots in Chicago, the police riot, which is mostly what it was, and then the subsequent, and the anti-war movement was extremely active and had the wind in its sails, and then it led to the, you know, a confluence of factors led to the election of Nixon. And, you know, with that historical parallel, it's kind of a bit alarming, because if one thinks of the Occupy movement as the sort of modern, you know, iteration of that anti-war movement, and then you think of the election coming up with the possible, you know, if the Occupy movement plays its cards badly, you could suddenly wind up with a right-wing reaction and, you know, elect not only a Republican Senate and Congress, but president as well, which would, you know, I mean, it's not that, you know, Obama's the great savior, or the, but I, there is a tremendous difference between a competent centrist administration and a demented far-right administration.
Absolutely.
That's something we've learned. So I think people have to learn that sometimes voting defensively, not because you're a utopian optimistic and think that your candidate's going to save the world, but just to avoid catastrophe, is sometimes even more important. So, but that's one parallel. I mean, there are many other things that are not parallel at all and where the world has really radically changed. So I don't think one can equate the two movements exactly, but there certainly are enough similarities that it gives one pause, you know.
Well, one thing also, just to talk a little more on the experiential level, just for a moment, is just how, you know, at that time, what felt like the available possible space within which to wage this kind of protest. Like, it was partly about moving through physical space, right? I mean, you were part of a, you know, campus activities. There were you know, riots. There were movements through the streets. What was the way in which the desire and the need to express, you know, an intense desire for change, how did it manifest itself, like, in New York City?
Well, I mean, I traveled a fair. I was in Europe a bit. I was one of these traveling troublemakers, so I got around. But you know, I think a few things happened. I mean, it was a very multifaceted movement, like most interesting movements, and it had, you know, the political components in which there, you know, people like SDS and later all the different organizations that emerged out of its fragmentation. You know, would march to Washington and do different actions, and then, you know, the Black Panthers and the Young Lords were doing their own actions, and again, it was a complex ecosystem. But one of the things that was interesting is that there was, you know, at the same time, an establishment of sort of alternative institutions, so that every niche of the, you know, of hipsters in different places, whether it be, you know, the East Village in New York or Ann Arbor or Madison or, of course, San Francisco and Berkeley and Austin and Iowa City and so on, had its own little enclave with its own, you know, food co-ops and its own radio stations and its own underground newspapers. And it was rather remarkable in that that began to feel like the norm, that we were slowly building our own counter-institutions. And it really lasted a very brief moment. But while you were in it, it actually felt as though that were the new normal. But it really, you know, blew up and disappeared very, very rapidly. And today I see some of the same things, but I think that one of the differences is that people still get utopian and carried away and a bit silly, as we certainly did. But at the same time, people are more realistic. They're a little more, by and large, younger people don't tend to trip out quite as much literally and figuratively as we did back in those days. And one sees the building of counter-institutions that are more long-lasting today. So you see, you know, people trying to build local economies, and some of that's silly. I mean, I think local currencies are never going to replace the dollar, or, you know, one could argue about that. But I think that there really is a kind of more serious long-term development of counter-institutions that's going on now, but beneath the surface. It's not discussed in the mainstream media that much. So that's an interesting development, I think.
Do you think that that's part of what sort of drove the, you know, pretty successful imprint of the Occupy ideas onto, you know, sort of the mainstream mind, behind the actual events, behind the performance, behind the spectacle, if you will, of this sort of strong reclamation of public space in this very demonstrative way, that there was also these more hidden but more kind of foundational things that were going on, or do you see them as just kind of parallel developments?
Well, you know, the Occupy movement, I mean, you know, this is one of the reasons that it's younger people who make revolutions, because once you get older, you've seen so much. You know, it's a bit like when you're a young heterosexual male and you see an attractive woman, all you can think about is the attraction and wanting to be with this woman. And as you get older, you say, ah, yes, but then after that comes the divorce and fighting over the children in the house. And so it's a bit with the same with revolutionary movements. You've seen so many come and go and been so cruelly disappointed that it's hard to fall in love again. But that said, I mean, obviously the Occupy movement really brought to the table at least a discussion of class issues in America, which has been, you know, not often discussed and which are very important. So it really did bring to the table a very important aspect of contemporary, you know, inequality. That said, it's, you know, unless it coalesces with some very specific, or not very specific, but at least some kind of overarching thematic unity, I'm not sure that it will really lead to all that much. It's hard to say. I think that there are many different historical parallels. I mean, there's parallels with the Hoovervilles, you know, and the encampments of veterans during, you know, after World War One.
Let's talk a little bit more about those, because, you know, I don't know that much about them, and it'd be interesting to hear the kind of resonance there.
Well, because, you know, with these Occupy little tent cities, suddenly a lot of homeless people started being involved because it was a place to be, and that created a certain amount of tension with the activists, because it poses all kinds of other issues, and then, you know, a few crimes occurred. And so some of the contradictions, I mean, that's the problem when you have an extremely utopian discourse, and then social reality sets in, you know, the limitations of weather, the limitations of space, the limitations of not being able to have a common platform, all these things set in. Now, the parallels with the tent cities, you know, that World War One veterans created, because they really, you know, there was no social safety net in those days. This is pre-Roosevelt, right? So the situation's really not the same. And that's one reason we haven't had the type of reforms this time with the collapse of the financial system that we had in the 30s, because in the 30s people really were desperate. There was no social security. There, you know, the social net is fraying now, but at least it still exists in some form. So that's a pretty big difference. People really were hungry on a large scale. I mean, there's hunger in America, but nothing compared to the 30s. So, you know, each situation is different. But there are, you know, it's a bit like the 2012 movement. There's some similarities to the Millerites, who thought the world was ending and waited on hillsides and sold all their farms in the 1840s. So,
well, but look, that's a really important kind of point, and I think it's something that we sometimes, you know, lose touch with, is that there are these moments, you know, and we can call them sort of, you know, you can call them radical moments or revolutionary moments or ruptures or something like that, where people are caught up in a tremendous sense of expectation and possibility. And oftentimes, generally, when you look at what actually happens after these moments, you know, they become complicated very quickly. They break down on their own internal contradictions. They're unable to translate themselves into a more conventional kind of organization that can affect the sort of large-scale structure of actual institutions and political dynamics and things like that. But at the same time, there's something about what politics really is about those moments, even in their sort of ephemerality. And I don't know, maybe you don't see that as much, partly because when you see these things happen over and over again, they look more like repetitions gesturing towards a possibility of change that keeps getting foreclosed. But sometimes things look so, I can be so dystopian about how control is developing, how the mind is sort of being shifted and constrained by media, social forces, et cetera, that just the fact that there, you can still have these ruptures of exterior forces that seem to actually create that utopian moment is itself already a great success, even if it doesn't necessarily translate into those things.
No, I quite agree. I mean, I think it's, you know, that I tend to look at things ecosystemically, as you mentioned, and you know, if one takes a longer sweep of it, it doesn't mean that one's always looking for the historical parallel and this is like that. You know, everything has a new octave, you know, a higher or lower octave or some new combination. It's more a spiral, or sometimes a downward spiral, sometimes an upward one. It's not a circle. But, you know, if you look at it, there are these moments of eruption, you know, what our old friend Terence used to call eruptions of novelty. And politically, you look at, you know, things like, you know, 1830, 1848, 1905, 1917, you know, 1968, where suddenly there seems to be something new in the air and this energy and there's rebellion everywhere. And we're definitely seeing that now. I mean, the Arab Spring is an incredibly important fundamentally important movement. It doesn't mean very often revolutions, you look at the French Revolution and it led to something, far worse than what it replaced in the short term, all the guillotine and the terror and then Napoleon and the restoration of the monarchy. But in the long term, the French Revolution was foundational in modern French democracy. So, we can't do without these eruptions of novelty. They're a bit like fevers that purify a body. You can't go through your life without ever catching a fever, whether ideological or physical.
And how would you compare, to see it, like you say, I watch the patterns, and in astrology, I'm not going to totally astrology out, but in the 30s, there was the same aspect that's happening now, which is Uranus square Pluto, and you can see, how when it happened the first, octave or iteration, it was the Wall Street people that were jumping out of their windows and, kind of the bodies were filling Wall Street in a different way. And then this time around, it's taken on a different flavor. But it's at the same time that revolution is breaking out, all over the place. So how would you kind of put the Occupy Wall Street movement into the context of the other revolutions that happened, in Tunisia or Egypt or, all over the place?
Yeah. I think that, some of this is mysterious, to what Jung describes as the collective unconscious. And sometimes if you look at history, it's really puzzling. It's as though why did the war break out in the former Yugoslavia? All the Yugoslavs that I knew when I was growing up, I grew up in a UN family, never mentioned I'm Bosnian, I'm Croatian, it was all I'm a Yugoslav. And suddenly, people are shelling Sarajevo, which is sort of like Aspen, where they had the Olympics. So there are mysteries as to why certain patterns suddenly erupt. That I think are deeply mysterious. Why the winds of history? It's almost like the Homer, the Iliad. That are there gods in the heavens who fighting their own wars? That suddenly, like archetypal battles in the astral planes that then get reenacted on Earth. I'm not taking that literally. I'm being metaphorical. But so part of this is mysterious as to why these things break out. And then you can look in hindsight at the social forces. But I would say that in answer to your question, something like Occupy Wall Street, I don't think it's nearly as fundamental a movement as the Arab Spring, which is coming out of a much deeper, sense of long-term stagnation and oppression in those societies. So I think that's a more important movement in the long term. But so it's hard to say. Often, if you're a historian, it's much easier to see these things 10, 20 years, later, looking back. So I don't really know. I'm not sure if the Occupy movement is just really going to fizzle and not lead to much, or whether, I think it's had value, and I've been actually kind of shocked at how well it's been received. If you look at the New York Times or the Financial Times, the sort of, center-right press, the mainstream press, it's been much more favorably received. The Financial Times has really been flattering about the Occupy Wall Street movement, which is kind of fascinating in and of itself. So,
that's the last thing. I don't want to spend the whole time on Occupy,
yeah.
But that was the one thing that I wanted to say about what seems to have affected it, to have left a trace, is not just in the media that you point out, including a surprisingly sympathetic or understanding perspectives from the mainstream, and even from people inside of, or sort of working inside of the current financial situation, almost as if there's some kind of awareness that something is deeply flawed, and they recognize that there's a legitimacy, and maybe partially because the claims are also economic, which are ones that they can understand, even if they don't necessarily agree with the way they're suggesting it. But even farther than that, it does seem like the whole long time repressed language of class in American politics, and even in awareness, that I'm a member of a class. Everybody I run into is sort of located economically in very specific ways. That seems to have really shifted in terms of discourse, in terms of the way people think of themselves and position themselves. And that seems to me like an example where an idea or a way of reframing who we are, just the 99% idea, forcing you to go, God, I guess I'm in that category. Huh, what does that mean? That it might really shift kind of how people even conceive of themselves as individual actors, and therefore that there will be results that come from that. As an example of how, like, ideas can still affect politics in terms of how people understand themselves.
Yeah, no, I think absolutely. And I think that's the most, whatever else happens with it, that's certainly been a valuable, very valuable contribution. I mean, it is a bit surprising in a way that with all our amazing media and interconnectedness, how the public discourse has to a large extent devolved. I mean, if you go back to the 1950s, you had people like C. Wright Mills at Columbia and Domhoff, who wrote this book, Who Rules America. They were really, you know, among the sort of intellectual elites, detailed looks at class society in America. And there were much far deeper analyses, you know, the word alienation, of how people were alienated, you know, in their suburban lives, in their factories. There was sort of a much, you know, some of it was Marxist, some of it was more psychological, people like Eric Fromm. And, but there seemed to have been there was a much deeper discourse about really root issues of the, you know, the problems of our civilization, you know, wrestling with technology. You don't hear much of that deep discourse these days. So at least something like Occupy Wall Street brings at least the class bit of it to public attention. But it's actually very timid. I mean, that 99% is, you know, it's a very clever slogan, but I'm not sure if it leads to really deeper analysis in the end.
Well, that's really where you know, we're left with, as with so much discussion of public discourse these days, is, you know, it's a good slogan. It's a, you know, it flies across the you know, the Twitterverse or whatever, and then there's still this sense that we're just snacking on clever phrases, on graffiti images, on you know, all these sort of percolating events, and that kind of deeper analysis that you talk about is not part of public culture. Because that's the other thing about these guys in the 50s, is that they were public intellectuals, and they actually had influence in a way that, you know, like Noam Chomsky today is an example of a dissident public intellectual that does have a fair amount of influence in certain circles, despite his being generally marginalized by the mainstream press. But there were just a whole host of characters from all across the spectrum that people, you know, educated but not intellectual people engaged with on some level or another, and there was a much richer sense of how people move through things. So it's the ironies in terms of the media are very strange.
Well,
around
even in the 1960s, you had someone like William F. Buckley, his TV show where he had Huey Newton and Allen Ginsberg. I mean, they really had debates for half an hour, an hour. And they didn't devolve into screaming matches. They were really, I didn't like Buckley, but it's amazing how far we've come and how backwards we've gone on that in that regard. I mean,
well, there's still a lot of stuff to talk about here, but we're going to take a break here on Expanding Mind. You're listening to Eric Davis and Maja Daou talking to J.P. Arbigny, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Daou, and we're here with Eric Davis and J.P. Arbigny, and we're talking about politics and consciousness and all that good stuff. J.P., I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about Anonymous. They're one of my faves, and, you know, some people have pinned the Occupy movement on them, but to me, you know, like how you were talking about that way that this wave will kind of catch on in the consciousness, the mysteriousness of it. I love Anonymous because of the way they'll utilize the internet to kind of catch a fire in people's consciousness about it. And I really loved everything they did with Scientology and, you know, Sarah Palin. What do you think about groups like that kind of catching these consciousness waves and being able to take it to levels like Anonymous did?
Well, Anonymous is, I think you'd have to look at for a historical parallel, it's a very small movement because it's a group of hackers, some of them probably very young. I mean, that's kind of the irony when I read newspapers, and the police are after Anonymous, it's probably a bunch of 15-year-olds.
Yeah.
Well, you know, so which is kind of impressive in its own way. But really, they're more in the line of small direct action groups, you know, whether it's the Weather Underground or some of the anarchist, people in the late 19th and early 20th century, and they're not violent in the same way as the people who blew up Wall Street in the back in the 20s or no, was it the teens? So, you know, it's a fascinating, and it's, of course, they're fascinating because they're dealing with a new technology space with this globalized web. The problem is when you get into direct action, there's always the risk of when you get in very, very small groups who have to be secretive, there are a lot of risks involved in that, both personally and politically. You can get very paranoid very fast. I know I was part of groups and we who were semi-underground and, you know, everyone suspects everyone of being a police agent and it can turn very dark very quickly. So there are personal risks involved in that type of activity and not just risks, you know, legally, but risks psychologically. And there's a danger of getting holier than thou, of feeling that we're the small cadre who know the truth. I mean, it is fascinating, and one can't help but smile at some of the stuff that they do. But I would just say that it's, you know, it's a risky enterprise on many, many levels.
Do you think that the risk kind of outweighs the effect that they can have? Like, I mean, I know there is that risk of obviously countering any kind of sort of governmental movement or even Scientology. I mean, Scientology is knowingly kind of sued the heck out of people, and there's all these stories.
Right. Well, you take on any powerful interest, and they'll come after you. No, I would never tell anyone what to do or not to do. You know, I'm just observing it. No, I was just putting out that cautionary note. But no, I think, you know, I would just advise people like that to really be as self-examining as possible and not to just emotionally react, but to really think of what it is that I'm trying to accomplish and then to do that as well as possible. So, you know, but of course it's very hard to tell a 15-year-old to think very calmly. I mean, their function in life is to destabilize things, and they're doing that pretty well. So,
I mean, it's kind of amazing, too, that the people that would kind of have the brashness to tackle these big things are kids. I mean, to me, I think that says a lot. It's almost like you said, it's like people that have been through the repercussions and responsibilities of, say, a divorce would be like, oh, I can't do that because I have
right.
to keep my job. But whereas a 15-year-old, they don't care, but yet they're the ones that can actually, like, catch a fire in these responsible people's minds about it, you know, and make them kind of like throw caution to the wind and
yeah, no,
involved.
You're right, and that's always been the function of youth. And then, you know, so it's one of these eternal dilemmas where, you know, some of the older people who've been around are more sophisticated and know more, but they don't have the hormones coursing through their bodies that gives them the courage to do what younger people do. So it's just one of those eternal tragedies, you know.
This might allow us to kind of go to the Arab Spring, because that is an interesting kind of parallel. Is obviously while there were many sectors of society that were represented, you know, in these various eruptions, that obviously youth played a very strong role, not just because they were young and were, you know, heedless of the consequences of their actions. In fact, in some cases, they were extremely aware of the potential consequences, very negative consequences of their actions, but also because they perceived in a way that I think maybe is even harder for older people to relate with anywhere in the world, let alone in from those societies, of just how shut down, how closed the future seems to so many, that there was this sort of like a go for broke aspect to it, which I think motivates, you know, also some of the people in the Occupy movement, though it's obviously in some ways unfair to relate them. So I'm curious on that level, like, how much do you see the Arab Spring as sort of occurring partly because there was a new space opened up either by globalism or by awareness of other protest movements elsewhere or by new media, and how much of it was this, you know, kind of internal to these societies, a kind of inevitable break with really repressive situations?
Well, I think, you know, again, that's a very complex and interesting question. I would say that, you know, these movements are both akin to, you know, older revolutions against very ossified systems, so something like the French Revolution, you know, in which you had a sort of feudal order. And so some of these societies are almost quasi-feudal, And so these have to be seen as, you know, reactions against an order. But at the same time, they're modern movements. They're plugged in and they're wired and they're part of the modern globalized world. So they're both. In a way that China, for instance, is economic development is very similar to the way Europe and America developed during the Industrial Revolution. They're sort of going through their 19th century, early 20th century phase. But at the same time, it's very modern, with many modern elements. So I think it's both at the same time. I think that the thing that people have to understand about revolutionary, and those are genuine revolutions, I think, is that they tend to, in the short and medium term, to have tragic results, usually. Because after a massive eruption of novelty, the energy wears down, and the larger swath of the society that's mostly peasants or, you know, people tend to be conservative in most societies. They don't want a permanent radical revolution. You know, the same thing happened in China where Mao wanted to have the permanent revolution. A society can't sustain that. So when you get a large eruption of novelty, there's always the morning after. And so we will have to, probably there will be more conservative forces that will clamp down a lot of energy. But that energy will still have been important to release, and it will have very important long-term repercussions. But sadly, a lot of the revolutionaries themselves in the first wave are going to be cruelly disappointed in what happens in the short term. So that's just something that we're seeing it already in Egypt as the more religious parties and the army begin to establish control. It's still important that they did it, absolutely, but one has to understand that these things work in cycles, and sometimes it takes many decades to get, you know, a really positive result. So that's one aspect of that.
Do you think there's something significant in the way in which that the Occupy movement clearly was sort of inspired by that, in the sense that part of the effect of the Arab Spring isn't just internal in terms of what's going to happen in these various, very different countries with very different political forces and are clearly going in very different directions, even though there was a lot of commonality in the events themselves? I mean, that there's almost something like a kind of global form of event that is shared and reproduced and mirrored across many different situations, and then they result in very different political situations, but there's almost something more, I don't know, collective about the move to the event itself. I mean, maybe I'm just being...
No, I think you're absolutely right. It's what I was getting at before with the collective unconscious and the eruptions. In 1968, there were, you know, Czechoslovakia, you know, the movements in the U.S., the Japanese students, the Zengakuren were completely going whack, you know. So there was, it was worldwide. And 1848 was very similar throughout Europe and even a bit in other places. So I think that this is quite similar in that regard. And in a way, it's this universal desire for liberation, for freedom, for ecstasy, that's a current, you know, it's a constant theme in human life, you know. You could look at it astrologically with the Saturn-Uranus dichotomy, you know. So I think that's a universal urge that has to break free periodically. That's what those eruptions of novelty are. I think that in the specific politics of it, I think that, you know, the Serbian student movement and some American pacifist thinkers had a big influence on the Tunisian students initially. And then some of the Arab Spring had a big influence on the people who occupied the square in Madrid. And that all happened before the Occupy movement here did. So, yes, but I think there are resonances. But, of course, each country and each region is specific with its own specific politics. And so that's when the specificity comes into play.
Well, and it is kind of crazy because that's a really interesting thing to me. Like, okay, say you're living in Egypt and you are, you know, kind of experiencing the poverty, or maybe like you're a woman and you're getting treated poorly. That kind of consciousness is so specific to the region. The thing that's amazing to me is that type of like feeling and flavor of some Egyptian young woman can spread to some, like, you know, kind of bougie dude living in New York, you know, maybe he doesn't have enough money to buy Starbucks every day, but he's certainly not suffering the same type of oppression that, you know, you could compare to many of the people in the Arab Spring. So the fact that it can kind of catch fire to things that are outside of their specific situation, but still that same kind of flavor. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated in the class level, the things you're touching on, because I think a lot of the students who were the real movers in the Egyptian and the Tunisian situations were more middle class. Now, of course, the middle class there is not what we would think of as middle class here, necessarily. But the poorest people in a lot of cultures, whether it was the serfs in Russia during the revolution or the people in Appalachia here or in the inner cities or the peasants in Egypt, tend to be fairly conservative and conventionally religious in many places. So often revolutionary movements are started sort of by segments of the downwardly mobile intelligentsia, an alienated youth, and some elements of the working class, but it's not the poorest people who tend to be the vanguards of most revolutions. Of course, there are different situations. So that's a very complicated, and again, it would be sociologically different country by country. But yeah, these are infinitely interesting but complicated issues, you know.
Well, so I'm curious, like you have a very grounded realpolitik approach to things. You're not easily swayed by kind of inflammatory rhetoric and utopian ideas, although you have your very strong convictions and values. And at the same time, I know you have had a very rich sort of background in spiritual and esoteric practices and thoughts and worldviews. And I'm really kind of curious having been around the block with a lot of these ideas for a while, how you see these, the kind of frameworks that are provided by thinking about consciousness, by thinking about the collective unconscious, about Jung, about the sort of more magical dimension of reality that can sometimes appear in our personal lives. Does it help or hinder the ability to really kind of grapple with what's going on a political level?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I think that, and this might go, really against what a lot of people want to feel. They say the personal is political, and everyone wants to really be holistic and have every part of their life be unified. I find that you sometimes have to keep things separate. I always say that, if you're going to take some ayahuasca, then you want to open your mind to the snake goddess and wriggle on the ground naked, but when you're doing your taxes or testifying before Congress, you don't want to do that. So you have to be able to wear different lenses. I think the postmodern condition demands of us that we be able to exquisitely, appropriately switch lenses. And I find that one has to, when you're dealing, you have to be appropriate to the world and to the niche and the sphere that you're operating in. So if you're an environmentalist and you need to testify before Congress, you need to be very rigorous with your, how many parts per million of mercury are there in this body of water. And you sometimes have to keep the mythic out of it. And then there are other times where it's appropriate. So, I mean, I'm a little uncomfortable discussing the winds of history and the collective unconscious in front of a more, mainstream audience.
Well, it's kind of funny, though. Like, to me, a lot of my heroes are individuals who can do all of those things you just talked about. Like, look at Iggy Pop, for example, who's one of my all-time favorites. He can, wriggle around naked like a snake in front of kind of important people and really kind of pull it off. And, I mean, I think that he can intelligently and coherently state things as well without necessarily compromising some of his more, soul-style beliefs. Now, that's not easy by any means, but I do think it's possible to have that happen.
Well, he's in a sphere where he's an entertainer, and our society tends to give a wide swath of permissiveness to artists and entertainers and writers, and so there are certain people who are given a wider latitude and are not as harshly condemned for having sort of original or ideas.
Right.
But I'm just talking about in the sphere of politics, let's say. There are people who are deeply spiritual. You take someone like Dag Hammarskjöld, who was the Secretary General of the United Nations in the 50s, who died in the plane crash in the Congo around the same time as Lumumba. he was a deeply, deeply spiritual person, but he didn't mix it up in his public life. You know, it came out later with his journals and his writings that how deeply spiritual a person he was. I'm reading now Marcus Aurelius, the great Stoic philosopher, of the Roman emperor. And, you know, he kept his journals private, and then it only later did it one realize how deeply spiritual a person he was. But, you know, he was a soldier, and he was chopping barbarians up in little pieces up on the German front. So, I don't know. I find that for me, I have to sometimes separate out what I'm trying to accomplish in which sphere of life, who I'm speaking to. So I find that I can't let it bleed it all together, but at the same time, I want to try to be a, you know, on some level, a unified person. It's not so easy. I mean, I find that as I've gotten older, I find that I have to separate more, you know, into different spheres of action.
Well, it's true. I mean, we are kind of required to be schizophrenic in a lot of ways. I mean, you look at politics and how it gets accomplished, and if people are overt about those kind of things, they lose people, and you can't affect as much change. I mean, unless you're like an entertainer or something like that, as you mentioned. I mean, to me, that's kind of a tragedy. It's almost like you have to go incognito in order to, like, affect any kind of change, which is interesting in all the Arab Spring and Occupy and Anonymous. There is this kind of thing about incognito. I mean, even the Anonymous movement, right? They don't say who they are, and they won't give their names. What do you think about revolutions and how it has to happen in a sort of identityless manner?
Well, I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. Are you referring to people like Anonymous who have to stay anonymous?
How these kind of movements, a lot of times individuals can't take responsibility, and they'll do it kind of on the sidelines or behind the scenes or influence it, you know, kind of without announcing themselves.
Well, look, there are different. I think one has to find one's niche in life. There are some people who, you know, act covertly. You know, for instance, it's been very important in many, you know, important social movements that there be people on the inside in the government or in the courts who are sympathetic but can't overtly show it. You know, that's been very important. And then there are other people whose role it is to be on the, you know, on the front lines and really publicly. I think there are different niches for people that have to do with people's individual psychological makeup, their fate. So that's complicated. You know,
one of the things
I
like about this sort of idea of political ecology is that it lets us think about the different, you know, masks we have to wear. In a way that, like, because I can see why you would say something like schizophrenic, like it's like we're split, where there's no way to unify all of these things. But the model of ecology is one where we recognize that there's a, our lives are and our work exists on a kind of topography, and we're like on this kind of mountain here. From there, you see this perspective, and these kind of people are around you, and you go over there. And I mean, because I know in my work, I've my whole career, I've gone from some very kind of obscure academic places to underground experiences and very marginal worlds, and, you know, mainstream media and writing for, you know, normal magazines, and changing and getting aware of how to change my language in a way not to kind of disguise so much as just to kind of recognize the appropriate kind of environment. And so I think it's, there is an element of schizophrenia to it, and it is sort of frustrating that there are these kind of limitations. But at the same time, if you want to keep things moving, if you want to, like, challenge the edges, you also have to be a bit of a shapeshifter.
Yeah, I would say that this gets to a very, very deep issue that has been a big theme for me, is I think that utopian aspirations, whether they're spiritual or political, tend to be totalizing. You know, people think that they're going to get the perfect society that's, you know, classless and no poverty and no suffering, and that they're going to have a perfect spiritual state where they'll understand everything and there'll be a heaven or whatever it is that they believe. And that's not the nature of things. I think utopianism is very important because it pulls us towards our highest aspirations, but at the same time, it's never realized. It's like if you ever, any practice that you do, whether it's yoga, Tai Chi, you name it, any interesting body of practice, you never get to perfection. You don't get there. The point is the journey. And I think that that's something that is harder to understand when you're young, that it's still worth doing, but you don't ever get there. And that's very hard for people to really reconcile. And I think in the political discourse, it's something that you don't hear, even from adults on, you know, in mainstream media. Or you just fall into the kind of completely cynical, pragmatic centrism that's devoid of any soul, which is, you know, I'd rather have that than crazed right-wingers. But the challenge is to find ways for your utopian aspirations to live so that your soul is alive, but at the same time you're a realist and you can function in the real world. And that's not easy. So I wouldn't call it schizophrenic, but you have to be extremely adaptable. You know, keep your moral core, but at the same time be adaptable.
Well, and it's true. I mean, they do dangle heaven in a lot of these really extreme movements. I mean, look at freaking jihad. I mean, if you do this, like, you'll get to heaven and have, you know, however many virgins you get and everything's good. And I mean, it's the same with, you know, a lot of the more Christian things. They do kind of use heaven as this carrot.
But,
you know,
it's not that different with 2012 and the Mayan calendar
totally.
Or the Occupy movement. We're all fall into
totally.
That.
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it looks to me of 2012, it's, I don't know, it looks like it's kind of sputtered a little bit. I mean, you know, it's out there. I'm not saying what's actually happening in 2012 and how weird and screwed up and bizarre this year can be. But, you know, for a couple of years ago, it looked like this was going to be some kind of, like, you know, rager, freak millennialist thing. And I don't know, it seems to have kind of lost its wad. I don't. How does it look from your perspective?
Well, it lost its wad because the world probably won't end, and then it's kind of hard to, you know. But, you know, people find. I remember, you know, the harmonic convergence, and I was kind of making fun of all my friends who were going to all these gatherings, and, you know, and then they were saying years later, oh, but that's why the Berlin Wall fell, you know, that's why, you know, so you can always project back.
Well, the world ends not with a bang, but a whimper.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. But, you know, look, this will be a crazy year. There's an election in the U.S. and Russia and France, and, you know, God only knows if the euro will fall apart. So, I mean, definitely there'll be things to point to. Because we live in a crazy time, and every year will be crazy because of the acceleration of technology and change. But, you know, I think it's a classic utopian movement. There's a tremendous amount of silliness in it. And it's something that I've despair because I just find there's so much bubble-headed thinking in the movements that I have to participate in if I want to be involved. And, it, you know, I like a lot of the ebullience, but some of the silliness just really depresses me.
Well, we only got like a minute or two left here. I know you can have the floor to talk about what project you're working on, or if not that, where are you really paying attention to things these days?
I would say that one important political point I want to make, I think that one of the reasons that there's been so much sadness about the Obama presidency is that I think people expected that, you know, he would be someone in line like a Teddy Roosevelt, not the imperialist Teddy Roosevelt, but the antitrust Teddy Roosevelt or Franklin Roosevelt, who would rescue capitalism from itself and really create a new paradigm. But I think that the reason he wasn't able to do it, apart from a bunch of mistakes, is that the power alignments have changed so that the financial capital has so much more power than it did even in the 30s, that the world is different, and we're between paradigms. The system is broken, everyone knows it, and no one really has an alternative at the moment, and it's a very unstable period because of that, and so it's very hard to know where things are going to go. But it's, I think it's by and large a fairly dark period. We're going to have to work our way through it.
Mm. All right. Well, JP, thanks so much for being on Expanding Mind.
Hey, pleasure.
Yeah, all right. From me and Maja, keep your minds open.